This is Scott Allen from odecoded.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded February 17th, 2009, and today we're talking to Scott Watermasek. So, Scott, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Scott Watermasek. I live in New Jersey, work for Intelligent Systems. I run the team that builds Community Server and Evolution and a couple other products. Been blogging for a while, built .txt a long time ago, which some people are still using some remnants of it. And that's about it.
So recently you've been writing about Azure on your blog, and I wondered if you could just talk about like some of your thoughts with it. First of all, like what your thoughts are on getting started in development, how easy it was to, get set up.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the Microsoft side of this stuff, I mean, they've done a good job presenting an easy set of tools to get things up and running. The fact that you can run just about the entire cloud locally, at least the Azure, compute and storage stuff, is definitely a huge win to kind of get things up and running. I've been looking at some of the Amazon stuff as well, and kind of the downside of that is, you immediately have to start paying money, to really do anything, kind of worthwhile on it. So I think that's been a huge win, providing those tools and making it easy to run stuff locally. Big picture wise, I think it's a huge deal. I've been trying to tell, people that listen to me, I equate it to, comparing ASP.NET to classic ASP. 5 years from now, I think, most people will be writing applications, and the enterprise side, will be writing, applications that are hosted in Azure, or other competing products. I mean, there's the big three, to Google, Amazon, and Microsoft out there, but there's a bunch of other companies that are trying to offer similar services or more niche more niche like services in that area.
You posted recently about concerns about lack of a roadmap and lack of kind of any specifics, and that's something we've
direction.
That's something we've kind of talked about a little bit recently too.
Just some kind of date and and direction as far as what they're going to release. I mean, I know they especially on the Azure side, they in typical Microsoft fashion. I mean, they've tried to hit a home run, right? So they're covering not just the storage, not just computing, but a set of services. You have the live mesh stuff on the consumer side, but like most businesses in this day, right? One of the selling points, or one of the things you always hear about the cloud computing, is right, the costs are lower to get started, to build your applications and all that kind of stuff. But you still have to make choices today as far as where you put your resources. And that's the part for me that drives me the most insane. I know what it's like to be on the other side, where people want a roadmap, and as soon as you tell them a date or a feature, even though they're not supposed to hold you directly to it, most people expect you to deliver on that date and that set of features. And I can only imagine what it's like on a Microsoft, side of that, of those discussions. But at the same time, I think it changes the game in so many ways that I think, myself, and I think, there's a bunch of other companies out there that would love to get started on it. But it's hard to say, hey, I have a team of 20 developers and I want to put five of them on it to build something that we think is interesting. But we have no idea when we can ship it. Is it a year from now? Is it 18 months from now? Is it going to cost, $20 a day to put our application out there? Is it going to cost $1,000? It's just, especially in today's, kind of economic climate, it's just really hard, to put a bunch of resources into something where you just don't know what that answer looks like. I know it's still pre-beta and that kind of stuff, but, I look at, competing programs or products like Amazon, who seems to roll out a new service, every other day. And bringing things to market. Google just made a big announcement, or semi-big announcement, because they haven't chatted about it that much, about the Google App Engine roadmap, and they've announced four features, at least in the social networking space, that I think will be pretty huge. And so I'm hoping, I don't know if you guys are attending Mix, but I'm going to be at Mix in a couple of weeks. So I'm hoping to see some big announcements there. And just some general messaging. I think the Azure blog finally, they finally found the password, for the account, and they started to write this week. So there's been, two or three posts, but for the most part, it's just been, one general post, and a couple other people from the team, or they're related to it, have been doing some posts here or there, but still very little information is getting out for what has to be a huge investment on Microsoft's part.
So, earlier you were talking about, comparing
Azure and App Engine, Google App Engine to the Amazon services, but they're really two separate approaches to the same kind of problem. And Amazon just lets you throw virtual machines up there. You configure them. They're basically just instances of Windows Server or you know, whatever particular brand of Windows you want to throw up there versus Google App Engine and Azure who provide more of a, well, it's a hosted environment, so you don't have control over the operating system necessarily. You just have interfaces into different services that you can call. And to me, it seems like they're approaching two separate kinds of development. So Google App Engine and Azure are approaching de novo development, you know, projects starting from scratch. You can afford to write their data services to SDS or to, you know, Bigtable versus existing, you know, applications that need to be able to virtualize their physical servers and then move them to Amazon instances and spin up new instances as necessary. And the reason that I think that's more difficult is that when you're the Azure and the Google App Engine platforms are more difficult to plan for. So generally the way that you would, you know, design for scaling is you distribute kind of your calls so that you have your servers on, you know, your database layer is abstracted away from your application layer so that you can put more servers, SQL servers or whatever into a farm and then just call into it and have the load distributed that way versus something like SDS where you don't really have to worry about, you know, how many instances you're spinning up or Bigtable. You know, you don't have that much control. You just kind of write your application to use these. And then I'm still kind of confused as to how the actual kind of round robining or the load balancing works when you spin up, you know, new instances of an Azure app or a Google AE application. Do you have to account for that in your code? I haven't seen anything in Azure services or the SDK that indicates, you know, when you get to a high load, then split it this way. You know, how do you handle things like sessions or, you know, logins? I'm assuming that like logins to Live ID and anything like that will be handled by, you know, just going to the same URL, but will, you know, switching to a different instance. Do you have sticky instances and so forth? And that's the kind of information that I want to see coming out of Azure, because they keep selling the scalability side of things, but they're not really showing us how, you know, do we just write, you know, simple hello world kind of code and just scale it by throwing more virtual hardware at it, or do we have to account for that in our code? So I don't know if anyone has heard anything about how that works. I've been kind of out of it since PDC.
I mean, I've heard some things. Actually, I got to go on site or, you know, up to Redmond for a week or so, or not a full week, but at some point, you know, November-ish and got some good updates. It was mostly stuff that was at the PDC. It was just the opportunity to actually ask questions and that kind of stuff. So I know some of the things they talked about was, you know, everything you do today in a portal will eventually be a web service. So you can't hold me to that. They can change your mind. But the goal is to eventually make all that stuff, you know, a web service. So that way, even your deployments become, you know, a managed RESTful API. So that way you can, you know, decide, and it's probably a whole nother, you know, decision as far as being multi-tenant or not being multi-tenant, and that kind of stuff. You know, but the other part, you know, kind of related to that is they brought up the idea of some of the other things are kicking around is making it so you can configure it and say, hey, you know, I want to start off on two instances. If I see increased traffic, it can grow to a certain number. I'm using my hands and you guys can't see that, but it can grow to a certain number. So maybe it's 5 servers, 10 servers, something like that to handle the traffic, but then making it so you can set an upper threshold as well, right? So that way you don't end up taking 1,000 instances and then, you know, you end up with some, you know, infinite bill, that you can't, you know, you might not possibly be able to pay. Just touching on some of the other things you kind of brought up. I mean, I think you touched on one of the big things, and that's, at least to me, you know, stuff that would be written for App Engine and Azure are really brand new things. You know, I've looked at what it would take to, you know, just to convert some simple applications that already exist and push them up there. And the whole kind of school of thought on it is really changing. There's a lot to kind of, you know, there's a lot of new things that need to be learned. I mean, I think Microsoft in that case has been pretty clear in the marketing side of it that you get to reuse your skills. You know, so if you know C# and ASP.NET and that kind of stuff, you know, all those things still work. But the way you manage data and the things you do with data and the fact that you kind of just more or less say, you know, screw normalization, it's not that big of a, not that big of a deal anymore, are all things that would be really hard, I think, to backport into many existing applications. And that's where for, in the case where if you had an application, you just want to stop managing, the hardware stack, that's where Amazon is probably, most appealing. Because that, like I think it was Scott that was talking, it said, it really is just a bunch of Windows servers, servers, and you get full control. I'm not smart enough on the networking side to figure out the whole, round robin and how you set up, the cluster and the IPs and stuff like that. So I'd probably need help from somebody in that regard. But it seems like it would be completely feasible in a way of quickly, getting out of the leasing or renting, the hardware per month or, co-locating your servers and that kind of stuff and allowing your site to grow when it needs to, and to leverage that full stack.
So when you're looking at architecture, I mean, it seems like one of the biggest things, like you mentioned, is your data approach is completely different because you're not normalizing. You're just kind of throwing out, it's just name value pairs basically, right? So how would you go about, building out an application in that? I think so many of us are just so used to conceptualizing things as from a relational database point of view. So how do you go about changing over to that new mindset then?
That's there. I wish I had the answer for. I mean, that's part of the guidance and stuff that I think is missing. It's not missing from just Microsoft. It's missing from everyone, right? There's only a handful of companies who have built stuff on that level, right? And I'm sure Facebook uses, I don't know if it's CouchDB or something like CouchDB. I mean, I know they use a lot of that kind of technology. I'm sure there's still, umpteen thousand MySQL instances floating around there for some of the stuff they're doing. With the Amazons and stuff of the world, there's only a few companies that have built things, that massive and use those technologies. So I think it's an area where there'll be a lot of exploration, a lot of learning. I imagine it'll be similar, right? I mean, if you guys take back, I think most of you do, ASP.NET. Type development, for a living. If you look at the things that you would have written 4 and 5 years ago, right? Those of you that you kind of cut your teeth on ASP.NET 1.0 or got started before the betas, and then look at what you're writing today, right? I mean, you feel a little sick, and want to throw a lot of it out. And I imagine there'll be a lot of that, 5 years from now, because just patterns will take some time to work out. I don't think these are a lot of things, historically, right? I mean, it's just so much new ground. So I don't think you're going to be able to fall back on, I don't even know what book would be a book with classic data patterns and stuff like that. I just think there's a lot of new stuff and there's just a lot of things, people are going to need to figure out. And that still just gets back to, the need for having some kind of roadmap. So that way you can better, kind of organize, and account for your time, where you're going to spend it and what you're going to build, because it's a completely different mindset. But unfortunately, it's a mindset that most people don't have just yet, because there's just so much to learn.
All right. So Scott, you've built a number of blogging platforms over the years, going back to .txt, which is powered, I guess, .NET Weblogs was the original URL for it.
Mm-hmm.
And
.NET Weblogs.com.
I fondly remember that one. That's where I got. That's my first, and my blog is still there at weblogs.asp.net. I just wondered, there's kind of a continual, like with Oxite coming out recently, and I know like for a long time, writing a blog was kind of like the hello world that a lot of people did, and then. My thoughts with having contributed a little bit to Subtext, which is based on .txt, is that there's so many edge cases and so many features that people don't think about, trackbacks and, just management issues and unclear APIs and scaling and all that. I just wondered what, some of your thoughts were on some of the more difficult things that people don't think about.
I mean, I think the most obvious thing people don't think about is that, the features don't make a blog successful. I mean, I don't want to be taken the wrong way, right? I mean, I work for a company who sells, kind of software in that regard. But there's so much emphasis put on how do I design it in the theming and trackbacks, which are, a colossal failure, if you ask me, and all these other things. And I think people neglect the fact that a successful blog is one that somebody writes on and writes on, you know, often, you know, and tells a compelling story. But as far as, you know, kind of features, I mean, trackbacks have always been, you know, kind of the bane of my existence, because they're so hard to test across platforms. There's, you know, a multitude of requests that go through. So even under the best situations, you're still reliant on calling out to some third-party server that you don't necessarily know, and that third-party server has to call back to you, and this is, kind of nasty handshake. So that's an issue. You know, trackbacks is something where I've spent, too much time in my life. And then the other big thing that's affecting, you know, lots of blogs, and the features still today aren't as good as they need to get, is spam. It's just, you know, kind of handling comments. How do you really engage users and make it easy to comment? And take it a step further, our own product, I'm trying not to sell, for internal stuff, supports bidirectional email, how to build into the product, making it so that way you don't have to necessarily, go back to the site to comment. There's a tool actually I use on my own blog called Discuss, which does the same thing. So anyone who has an account and leaves a comment on my blog can follow up an email, and I can respond to them in email. So it's a great way of keeping people engaged. Those are features that are you know pretty hard to figure out. If you've ever tried to write an application that both sends and receives email, and kind of getting back when I had mentioned, one of the features that the Google App Engine folks mentioned that really has me excited is they're saying that, and they haven't given any details, but they're saying in the next version of it, they're going to support bidirectional email, which is a hard problem to solve for a lot of applications. Or not a hard problem, it's a hard problem to solve, but it's a problem that actually can enhance, a lot of applications. Still the number one mobile tool, right, is everyone has email now on their BlackBerrys or iPhones, or people apparently use Windows Mobile. And that kind of stuff. And so if you can kind of get in their inbox and do interesting things, you really open up a lot of opportunities. And that's an area where I've made a lot of investment in, my team and Intelligence made a lot of investment over the last couple of years.
Bidirectional email, so it can accept email, it can send email.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's Zawinski's law. It's already satisfies Furry Goat's law. Being a blogging platform, so Zawinski's law is that every program's features expand until it can read and send email, and then Furry Goat's is that every program's feature set expands until it can consume and produce RSS.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. So,
okay, Scott.
Yeah, not a question about blogging platforms per se, but there was a tweet from Anderson Imes who wanted to know who knew you were on the show and wanted to know what you thought about Silverlight and if you see that in any of your products' futures.
Silverlight's an awesome technology as a whole. I mean, we still build software for what customers ask us to do, and still kind of at this moment, right? We still just have one customer who asks us for Silverlight. You may have heard of them. They reside in the upper Northwest. Big sprawling campus and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, we're starting to see a little bit more of it. I'm excited to see what they mentioned for Silverlight 3, kind of that mix. It's for better or worse, it's always a Microsoft rub, right? You wait to version 3, to kind of do stuff. So, for me personally, I'm so unvisual. And every time I try to do something that's visual, it just, you can tell I tried. And so it's even worse. So I haven't gotten too much into it. I've kind of, committed myself to figuring more out about it, in this year, because it's a technology. It's something I haven't gotten, too much into. I've kind of viewed it almost as, kind of as another set of controls, something where, leveraging components that have already been written. But there's a lot of interesting things that you can do with it. Media and stuff are obvious, but, just being able to do, bulk uploads, chunking of uploads, and being able to do that cross-platform. There's a lot of things from the business stuff I do, in day in and day out where Silverlight would be beneficial. It's just getting it on, on everyone's machines and getting users educated with it. Getting developers educated with it, which still seems to be, the big drop off. And we're at various times looking for people with those kind of client side skills, with JavaScript and Flash and Silverlight and stuff. There's not a lot of people out there, not a lot of people out there yet who are doing it. So.
Yeah, And there are a lot of weird things that you don't think about working with Silverlight. There are just so many different challenges that, you know, are, you know, like what, where you're at and what your rights are. And it's, you're writing C# code, but it's running in the browser, and it's, you know, it's definitely strange. I think that just so much of this is waiting on, I mean, I think Microsoft's strategy is pretty clear on getting Silverlight out there just by, you know, getting as many media things set up. And so hopefully that gets it on desktops to the point where it's more worthwhile to do more with it than media.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this week, right? They're going to do the NCAA March Madness, right? Isn't that going to be Silverlight based?
I'm very, very familiar with that application right now. Yes. So, yep. So
that's cool. I mean, it's a huge thing for me. I'm a huge basketball fan, so it's much more so than even the Olympics. So I think it's a good way of going about it. I guess it all probably comes down to, you know, Windows 7, if that's a hit. I imagine that Silverlight in some way, shape, or form will be a big part of that. It just leads to other things, right? I mean, I always go back to the Azure stuff, but the live mesh type applications that you can do on the consumer side, there's a lot to it. It's just a matter of, you know, getting it out there and getting it installed. That will open up the doors. I mean, we still see from our enterprise type clients, they're still an IE6, and no real reason to move forward. I'm sure you guys probably talked about that in the past. And so that kind of kills us for anything we'd want to do, you know, kind of Silverlight related, when we know that a big set of our users just won't even have it as an option.
One kind of hope for getting the corporate shops off of IE6 is IE8. At least that's the hope, is with the compatibility view and all that. I saw some of your Twitter stream on that today. What were your thoughts so far on IE8?
Man, that's a loaded question. I kind of committed myself to, you know, for the next, you know, couple of days of using IE8. Just because we, like I said, we have a product, you know, we're going to ship a version, and IE8 is probably going to roll out after that. And so I want to make sure we're as up to speed as possible, and you know, accounting for the area. So I've kind of committed myself to playing around a little bit. And it's just, I don't know, it's been frustrating. I look at it, and again, I don't know the full backstory inside Redmond. But I look at it and go, man, they own the OS, right? I mean, they own the full stack. And I know that they'll get in trouble in Europe and other places that they cheat. But I just look at it and go, man, this thing should be faster than any other browser on my computer. And it is by far, I mean, I don't have a scientific test. I'm sure you can, you know, Google and find people who have done it. But it's clearly not the fastest by a long shot, on my machine. And it just, you know, frustrates the heck out of me in that regard. I'm not big on the side of the Firefox with the extensions and that kind of stuff. There's some things that, you know, that I like and I wish I could do. But I was playing around with the accelerators last night that you can do, and there's some interesting things you can do there. But again, I kind of look at it and go, why can't I write, you know, C# or even you know, Python or Ruby, you know, whatever it is, you know, something that can kind of be hosted in a browser in a rich way, and allow me to really use the browser as a rich platform tool going forward, and not, you know, have to, you know, fall back on Firefox, which again has a huge following and lots of extensions and its own language and stuff that I've never really gotten into. I just look at it and go, man, that's why, you know, Firefox, and again, I don't have any proof for this, but, you know, why Firefox is so successful is, you know, all these add-ons and that kind of stuff. It's not that it renders better markup, right? There's only, I don't know, 1% if that of web users that are, you know, geeky enough to understand CSS and HTML and can tell you if something's rendering in standards mode or not standards mode and stuff like that, to care. Most of the people care because it's, it feels faster and can do all these other things outside of pure rendering. But again, I'm on the other side of that where I just wanted to render fast. And so that's why I primarily use Google Chrome as the browser I use most. And it's because it just feels really fast. Whether it's smoke and mirrors, drinking the Google Kool-Aid or whatnot, it just feels really fast. And IE8 just doesn't feel, you know, any faster than IE7 was. And I just look at the new features, and there's just nothing that's super appealing for me in that regard. I mean, I wish I could write code in it, because I just think, from someone who ships and sells a, you know, web-based software, there's a lot I could do if I could program, you know, kind of write in there. And again, it probably gets back to, you know, maybe John will mention the you can be doing that kind of stuff in Silverlight, but there's a lot of stuff you can do, kind of directly in the browser, and you don't necessarily want to, push the Silverlight. So.
No, I totally agree.
If I had a dollar for every time John and I have been in an IE chat and asked the question, when are we going to have managed add-ins that aren't just, common or op?
Yep.
We'd be rich.
It just seems like something easy for them to solve. I don't know their problems, and I know, everything they do, they have to make sure, all Europe doesn't, cry foul or, and that kind of stuff, or, European Union. But it just seems like something so easy for them to solve, right? I mean, they got the CLR to work on OS X, right? And now there's a group of people that got it to run on Linux, but yet they can't get it, running in Windows on their own thing. I don't know. I'm sure there's a reason for it.
Here's my thought on the reasoning behind it. And I asked, at PDC I sat down and I saw a table with Raymond Chen at it, and I said, holy crap, I get to ask Raymond Chen a question, and maybe he'll tell me, I didn't phrase my question correctly, but I'm going to ask him. And this is, I went over and asked him, I said, so when are we going to be able to write explorer.exe add-ins using MEF? And some other guy chimed in and said, you won't, never. The shell is native code. And that's why I think that we still don't have any kind of a managed add-in for IE, as because it's still tied to explorer.exe way down deep, and they're just not going to, that's a whole different team from the IE team that owns that part of the code, and they're just not going to let it go. They're just not going to, they can't give up. To enable that kind of, add-in capability would mean a rewrite of explorer.exe. And for some reason, and this isn't particular to the Microsoft platform. OS X has the same problem with the Finder. They cannot seem to pull the trigger on the rewrite of the main interface to the file system.
I know. I have faith that someday Scott Goo will own IE and own it all. So I have faith once again in Scott's, in the greatest, Scott of them all in the .NET world, hopefully someday he will conquer, that side of the world. Maybe they'll just start off and give him, IE and see what he does with that. nothing tells me this is absolutely true, except for, when I first met him, he was showing me this little, ASP.NET thing, this small team, and he now seems to own, a sizable percentage of Redmond. So I have faith, but I think that's what it's going to have to, come down to. I'm sure there's others,
It's going to have to be a rewrite. Yeah. There needs to be a skunk work. There needs to be some kind of little project that no one cares about that is a rewrite of, the browser. Maybe they make some kind of a deal with Gecko. Maybe they make some kind of deal with WebKit. I'd prefer WebKit. They do something. Something's sure. Got to give.
They
got to rewrite the interface.
Yeah, I mean, basically take WebKit, wrap it in a managed app, and then throw in, whatever the best new stuff, MEF, and whatever things that would allow for managed add-ins. I mean, it's like, there's your browser, and instantly you've got better support and faster rendering than IE8 has. I don't know. It just seems like an option they should at least look at.
I think it would solve a lot of problems because they do seem to be in just a strange situation now where I don't think there's really anything they could do in IE9 or IEv next that could really get momentum back into the corner. But if they just started over with a fresh rewrite, I think they could, come up with something a little better. Plus, I think one of the big problems with managed add-ins in either the Explorer shell or in Internet Explorer is the whole versioning issue of only being able to have one version of the .NET runtime in a process. And I know that's a big reason that you cannot write shell extensions with managed code, because if I write an extension and it gets plugged into the shell and I'm using version 2.0 of the runtime, then I've kind of hosed anyone else who wants to write an extension and get it loaded in. And I think that problem could happen in IE2. But if they just started over with a managed version and said, look, this is our new web browser, it runs on version 4.0 of the CLR.
So I had a question going back to blogging. One thing that I thought was cool, and I'm a fan of OpenID and have been for a while, and I thought it was cool that Community Server has support for it, and Graffiti does, and there's also, I believe, Telligent contributed or worked with the .NET OpenID project.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. So I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the, you know, how that came up, and what was there a driver for that external to, you know, was that a customer ask, or was that just something that you guys thought to move the platform forward, or, you know, how that came up?
Probably a little bit in between. I mean, we did have some customers, who brought it up. In a similar vein, we have customers saying, you know, where's Facebook Connect and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I don't know the full details. I know, Jason Alexander had known, and I'm forgetting the guy's name, who's kind of the lead on the project. They kind of known each other. And I don't know the exact details, but I know Telligent had some kind of arrangement to help, fund that or contribute to that in some way, shape, or form to help push that out. Because we didn't have the time or the expertise, kind of at the moment to do it ourselves. And so it's something we put in the product. There's some customers that are using it. I mean, right now the whole multiple login things, right? If I should use a username or password, or I should use OpenID. I think we started with, we were looking at CardSpace, and we had done some preliminary work to get CardSpace working. But again, Microsoft was interested, but non-Microsoft customers just weren't that interested in the moment. And so, yeah, we kind of went back to the drawing board and implemented, support for OpenID in the product. And so it seems to work well. I think it's got one gotcha where it doesn't work on your Medium trust. So we had to do some other things to kind of load it, to load it a little bit safer. But it's one of those things, depending on your community and then what you want to build, it can certainly be helpful.
All right. So you've said that SQL is the new COBOL, and just wondered, why you say that and why that drives DBAs crazy.
I kind of look at it and go, so I'm definitely late to the game in the whole, in hybrid and ORM thing. And I'm going to imagine you guys have debated that at nauseum and whatnot. And if you haven't, that would be a good show at some point as well. But I just think it's past the point of where we're writing, SQL is beneficial. And there's multiple reasons for that. I mean, tools like nHibernate and whether you like nHibernate or Link to SQL or, any framework, whatever it is, they all do a good job of kind of abstracting you from SQL. But I just think in the future, we're going to take it a step further and where we don't necessarily have to even rely on SQL anymore. And this kind of gets back to some of the cloud stuff and just, the tools that are available. But back in the day when relational databases and stuff were becoming, kind of more mainstream, they were solving, interesting problems, but they just had limiting computing capacity, how close you had to be to the data and the capacity related to that. And so now I think with tools like, the Azure computing stuff, there's the CouchDB, and variety of tools. There's just a lot more kind of at your disposal. The hardware is kind of caught up with what people want to do, and so the compute processing, if everything isn't super normalized and sitting right next to each other and with proper indexes and keys and that kind of stuff, the computing capacity is there probably today to say, hey, we don't even need to worry about those things anymore, right? We can just worry about our objects or entities or looking at the CouchDB kind of stuff. We just look at our documents or I can't even name the other tool where it allows you to do just kind of push in key value pairs. The hardware is kind of caught up. The mindset's changed a little bit. I love that. I forget who coined the term the apology based computing. But for large scale systems, it's kind of okay. It's not okay for your bank, right? To never know if you actually have 40 cents in your account or 42 cents in your account. It's probably a depressing number for the economy, saying you have 40 cents in your account. But the fact that people, that the mindset of people seem to be okay, that the inventory isn't 100% correct, just as long as you don't charge me, kind of extra, kind of in the future. The bigger picture or the thing that kind of drives me is that, the computing capacity is there now, that we don't necessarily need to worry about all these mundane details. And I think that we'll see over time, there's going to be less and less people writing SQL. It won't go away, tomorrow or even 5 years or 10 years, but I think most people in the coming years just won't have to crack open SQL Server themselves and profile and trace and do all that kind of boring stuff that you have to do today.
So you're talking not just about like SQL itself, but even really getting rid of relational databases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's that. I didn't even touch on the whole, because I haven't spent a lot of time with the whole idea of just like an object database. I think that was on the Alt.net podcast, where there a couple guys talk about that. There's just a lot of options, right, that frankly 10 years ago or 5 years ago just didn't have the computing capacity, at your fingertips that people are going to have either in the cloud or the fact that you can buy a complete kick-ass server, right, for a couple $100. This options that you didn't have yesterday are going to be there. And if you look at that, and if you look at the fact that for most applications, milliseconds don't matter for what most people do. And if you can save yourself, weeks of headache in development and messing around SQL and just kind of roll something out, I think it's very appealing for people going forward.
Well, my general philosophy has always been that once you hit the file system, for whatever reason, then any little nitpicky performance increases that you're trying to make through your code are completely negated. Because that disk access is always going to be the slowest part of your system. So a lot of the people that argue against ORMs and say, you need to use sprocs and indexes, don't take that into account that, you're still making the hard drive spin up. So, solid state drives are faster, but, the biggest one right now is 320 gig, I think I've seen for $10,000. No one's going to be, populating their server farm with SSDs anytime soon. You can make the argument that, load up most of your tables in RAM if you have enough RAM on your system, but again, that's not very practical. But the biggest problem I see is that people try to apply the ORM argument in every situation. They say that, no matter what, you should be using an ORM, when for the most part, 90% of the time you're going to be able to get by with in Hibernate or Subsonic or even Entity Framework, God help us. But there's that 10% of the time when you're doing some kind of complicated cube or an MDX query that you just can't represent in a Hibernate's query language or anything else. And when you really need to get that close to the tables and either normalize it to something that in Hibernate or an ORM can handle, or you just need that processing power, say if you're doing lots of large-scale data warehousing, then that's when you need it for that 10%. You go in, and I think writing pure SQL or indexing or whatever in those cases is perfectly acceptable. And most of the people that I know that write ORM tools agree with that.
Yeah, I agree. No, there's never going to be any one tool or one way to do just about anything.
And I think, the best ones are, and I think pretty much all the ORMs have those kind of safety valves now, where it's like you can represent, you can use a view or you can call out to a proc and get your value and cast it or turn it into your ORM object or whatever. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see then, too, if those start getting hybrid ORMs or an ORM that can, the way that ORMs simplify data access for us now with relational databases, I wonder if we'll start seeing that kind of thing that will simplify our big table or CouchDB or that sort of thing.
I think one of the first podcasts we ever had, I'd kind of mentioned, it's 2008. Why am I still thinking about accessing a database at all? Why isn't there some kind of magic API that I can call that will just persist my objects for me? Not necessarily an object database, but I don't get why I have to think about how I'm structuring my data when I'm modeling my application necessarily, and why those performance issues or any performance issues aren't automatically kind of optimized for me. We can put a man on the moon and we can make a little robot out of Tinker Toys and have it tool around on Mars for 5 years longer than it should have, but I'm still writing select top 10 from and doing all these other little things, where 1 = 1 and all these stupid little tricks to try to optimize queries, or I'm worrying about my database whatsoever. I, I want to be done with it.
Yeah, I just following up on something John was saying. I agree that something I've been kind of interested in lately is, you know, one of the things that ORMs give you is, or some ORMs anyway, is an abstraction away from database platform specific ugliness, you know, or differences between Oracle and SQL Server. And, you know, those are nice, but not like earth shattering when you're talking about basic relational databases. But the potential to extend that to sort of non-traditional relational-ish stores, it becomes much more interesting. So where, you know, you're persisting your object as something that's really not a relational database anymore, and you can still use the same mechanics. You can still use, you know, and hibernate with its Azure provider. That becomes like even more compelling to me. I don't know if anybody's doing that yet. I don't know if there's any major barriers to that, but it's certainly something that I would be interested in exploring more.
And even when you do abstract away from the underlying database engine brand or type, you still end up with a one-to-one ratio of tables to objects, basically. You know, you're just representing the tables in your database in code. I've seen very few instances where your domain objects don't map directly to tables. But, you know, maybe that's just me. Although being able to not have to worry about, you know, PL SQL's differences versus T-SQL differences is nice. Just baby steps.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common. And in fact, in Eric Meyer's book, he pretty much says if you can get away with having your tables resemble your objects, you're probably going to have an easier road in any case. But nice thing about ORMs is you don't have to do that. But I wanted to comment on, I think, what Scott Kuhn was saying earlier. I still work with some people that like to develop starting with the database, and they're very concerned about data. And they'll basically say things like, the data is going to be here 20 years from now, but your application isn't. So the driver for this thing is going to be where we store the data and how we store the data, and we're going to make sure that we can get the data out using any tool available in the future, which isn't necessarily how I see the world, but I can appreciate their viewpoint.
That's why it should all be an XML, right? With
That's right.
I'm joking, of course. All right, so I had just a couple of quick questions. One is, I know you manage a remote team and have been working remote for a long time, and I just wondered what, you know, how you got into that and how that works for you, like what you do in order to be productive in that kind of environment.
Yeah, I mean, when I first did it, I don't know about you guys, but I've been working remotely for almost 5 years now, and when I first, you know, kind of got into it, for myself and just about every developer I knew, it was kind of utopia. Everybody wanted to, you know, work at home and then I'll commute and all this other kind of stuff. And I've kind of learned, you know, after doing it, that you need the right mindset, you know, to do it. So I'm very comfortable being home, completely by myself. I think I was actually going crazy when we had our first child and my wife and a baby were around, because I had been so used to being, you know, kind of home by myself. But when I interview people now, it's definitely something we bring up. Because like I said, I used to think it was something everybody could do, but I know I always use my wife as an example. But she would go nuts if she had to work at home by herself because she needs somebody to talk to. And I have proof of that because she drives me crazy when she works at home with me, because she just kind of walks in and she just wants to talk about what's on her mind or kind of what's going on, or she has a question. And I've, you know, kind of gotten, you know, so used to being at home and it being quiet and kind of getting myself, you know, kind of in the zone. That I definitely learned is for the right kind of person, you know, in the right kind of mindset. You know, going down to the intelligent offices and stuff, it's a really fun place to be. So I could see myself, you know, kind of hanging out there more as well. But I know going forward, I'd always be, you know, super picky, you know, about the kind of office and that kind of stuff, because I've been so spoiled, you know, working at home. But as far as I think, you know, some of the other things you're asking about is just, you know, finding the right people and that kind of stuff. And it's definitely something where, you know, where we lean towards, you know, more senior people, you know, people with experience. You know, working remotely is definitely something much harder to do for junior level kind of people. It's probably the same thing you'd say for any kind of hires, is you know, the better people you hire, the more likely they are to be successful, you know, in that kind of environment. But it's, you know, it's really finding people that are self-motivated, great communication skills, even more so than your average developer, your average dev shop, because you don't have whiteboards and that kind of stuff nearly as much at your disposal. You start to leverage tools, you know, like we're doing now with Skype. We use a tool all the time, on a team called TalkBox, which is similar to Skype. You know, the sound quality isn't as good, but they allow up to 9 to 10 people, I think, to do video chat. And so when you're working at home, you know, kind of by yourself, and as the team's grown, it's nice to be able to put a face, even if it's a developer face, kind of in the morning. And it's, you know, interesting. It gets you a better look into the personalities of everybody in your team, right? You know, who are the people who get up first thing in the morning and get dressed and that kind of stuff? And who are the guys that just roll out of bed and hit the power button? And they're kind of ready to go. And so I think over the last year or two of using those tools where we didn't use them for the first couple of years, it's actually, I think, helped everybody get to know each other a bit more.
Yeah. One thing that I always appreciate when I'm following your blog is that you're always writing about new technologies and you always kind of jump in and do a quick evaluation, whether it's, Velocity or, new things from Google or just new web services and that kind of thing. So I just wonder how you go about like managing that. How, obviously there's just a continual flow of new technologies coming out, how you pick things and how you get in and figure out how to use them and that kind of stuff.
There's so much coming out, right? I mean, especially even if you just look at it from developer tools and stuff from Microsoft, right? I mean, think about what it was like when you first started to learn .NET to what it's like to learn .NET today, right? I mean, you didn't have Velocity and Link and ASP.NET MVC or web forms or the umpteenth million other things that are out there and in the open source community. So when it comes to new stuff like that, it's usually personal time. So I always look for things that just really, kind of interest me. So, anything, kind of web related, the cloud stuff has definitely been something that's really, piqued my attention. For tools, I always look for things, any kind of way to get, just a little bit of productivity gain. I remember when I first started, getting into software, I was working in market research, kind of at the time. And I was working with a bunch of PhD kind of people, and I had slowly started to learn how to write code. It was kind of, it was like my leg up, right? I wasn't going to be able to outthink these people who had PhDs, in the industry I was kind of working in and that kind of stuff. But I was able to out-crunch them in data because I was able, even though it was probably the most craptastic VB type code, kind of ever written, I was able to churn through, kind of mountains of data, faster than they were. So anything where you can get, kind of productivity gains, is something that kind of, kind of really piques my attention, and gets my time. It probably is counterproductive, to being productive, trying all these things. But I mean, similar to you guys, I fall back on reading, lots of other blogs, look for areas where a couple people have talked about it. Twitter's a great, great reference for finding interesting tools and services and that kind of stuff and kind of falling back on the masses to help you do your homework. But at the end of the day, it's just a matter of, kind of clearing out some time in your schedule and just getting down and playing with it. I think as you get more senior, you can make those decisions probably a little bit quicker as far as what you like and what you don't like.
So you mentioned MVC, Scott, and you guys, Intelligent, have built some pretty sophisticated stuff on top of web forms. And I'm curious whether you guys are looking at MVC, have looked at MVC, are looking at what you can do there. Has it piqued your interest?
So it definitely has. I mean, I look at it and I really like what it brings. I think it brings a simpler model, right? I mean, there's the whole separation concerns and all the testing and all that other kind of, good stuff that's written about, ad nauseum about it. And they're all, good and valid things. But I just like that it's just a simpler model, right? It's not wiring up to these five, page events and all that kind of stuff. So as a whole, I mean, I really like it and like what it brings. I imagine new products we do will probably leverage it. For existing products, like you said, I mean, we have, whether you love it or hate it, the WinForm model, we have a huge investment in it. And the MVC stuff, you know, while it's definitely beneficial to developers, it really doesn't solve our users' problems. And our users want things like easier upgrade stories and the application to run faster and that kind of stuff. So we'll certainly for, you know, community server and evolution and stuff like that, stick with web forms. But it's largely because, you know, rewriting it, you know, doesn't bring a lot of benefit to our users. But I certainly see us using it, and at least for myself, personally, for side projects and, you know, kind of things I hack on the side. I really like what's there. So I'm pretty easy in that regard. I know people have some concerns about things they like and don't like about it, but I think it's an improvement on web forms. And so, as I said, I'm pretty easy when it comes to that. And so I'm willing to move on to the next better thing, even if it's not, you know, perfect, you know, at the moment. So
anyone else have any other questions?
I actually just want to give a thanks to Scott. I actually got my blogging start back on .NET web blogs many months ago, back when it was like, you know, a couple dozen people on Scott's personal website. So
back when I was an idiot and didn't think there was money in blogging. Good God, it was a dumb decision on my part, man. I should have had ads all over that sucker. And that was the dumbest thing I've done in my business careers. I just remember people saying you should put ads on it. You should try to sell .txt. This is a long time ago. I don't know if you guys know Greg. I forget his last name. The guy, you know, CTO over at NewsGator. And he tried to convince me, to do something with blogging and sell it and stuff. And I was just like, you're an idiot. There's no money in this stuff. I'm going back to the healthcare job or whatever I was doing. And, you know, I was very, very wrong for that. You know, that's it. So now, you know, good to hear this. I see you still blog over there. You know, you did his day job, so that's cool. But,
well, not so much with the blogging these days, but I still have a blog.
I think Twitter's killed a lot of blogs indirectly.
I don't know if that's better or worse. You know, I mean, it's a different way of consuming information. It's definitely a lot quicker. I find that, you know, there's a lot of things that I would have written a blog post about before, and I would have been struggling to pull together a bunch of information when really all that's needed is 140 characters, you know, with a link, you know, hey, check this cool thing out, you know.
So.
Yep. Ah, kids killed blogging.
It's true.
We all got older and got our wives pregnant or became pregnant ourselves.
Right.
In the case of the women bloggers.
I look back and I did months where I had like 150 posts and stuff. And it's like, I know it's just pure garbage. I was just throwing out there. I think like John said, it probably would have been better if I'd have kept myself to 140 characters for it. But I don't know how I did it. It just had to be pre-baby and pre-marriage and stuff. I have no idea how I would do something like .txt today. I have no clue how I would fit it in, life today and start something like that. I'd be naive enough to start something like that today. I wish I could, because it was fun. But
I'm curious if you sort of keep the corner of your eye on subtext, you know, as sort of the open source fork of your original baby. Do you kind of keep a watchful look to see how it's developing?
Yeah, I mean, I love it. So it's, you know, when we first started, you know, doing a community server stuff, and I saw I did that. You know, it was a concern a little bit, right? Because I was banking my livelihood, on doing this stuff. But I've kind of learned since then that, you know, different people will use subtext versus people who buy enterprise software, you know, that kind of stuff. So no, I love to see that it keeps going. It sounds like I haven't talked with Phil in, you know, a long time about it. I know Phil a little bit, you know, but I don't know, great where I pick up the phone and call him and stuff. But it looks like they're starting on a new version, and I'm guessing they're writing a bunch of it from scratch. You know, it seems like from his blog post and the things I've seen him do it. So I think it's a good thing, because I don't know about you guys, but I look at code I wrote a couple months ago, and I think I wrote about this, you know, earlier this week, and I get nauseous, and I can only imagine, oh my God, what's in, you know, if any of the .txt code's still around. I mean, that stuff's like 7 years old now. Maybe closer to 8 years old. I can only imagine what I was doing, at that time. I mean, the fact is it still works, which is great. But yeah, I'm happy to see, subtext, still doing well. And there's all the alternatives out there. I mean, there's a blog engine .NET, which I've never, you know, used myself, but it looks like it's a pretty, you know, pretty strong application. And, you know, and that kind of stuff. So there's lots of options which weren't there at the time. I mean, it's you know, the only reason .txt exists is, you know, it was a necessity. There's nothing like it at the time, or nothing I could find, you know, kind of like it at the time. So.
Okay. Well, thanks a bunch, Scott. Appreciate your staying up late and joining us on the call. Really appreciated the conversation.
Cool. Thanks for having me. It was a good time.
All right. That's it for this week's Herding Code. We'll catch you next week.